Welcome, everyone, to the Feeling Lighter podcast, where we are shedding old beliefs one episode at a time, because the bottom line is how you feel about yourself actually changes everything in your life. So yes. Isn't that the truth, Lisa?
So true.
It's like we just say that, but when you really sit in that for a while, it's like, oh, actually, that informs every behavior in my life. So,
yep.
I'm really excited about our guest today. We're going to be talking to the Secure Relationship therapist. Mm-hmm. And I love her content on social media. So important.
Right.
And I know that we're, you know, with this podcast, our intention is to address the mentality side of the wellness space. Mm-hmm. And people are like, why are you guys talking to secure relationship people? And why are you talking about racism? And why are you talking? I'm like, because these are the root things that allow us to like shed beliefs and think about ourselves and show up in the world in a different way.
Absolutely.
So if we actually have desire to shift our mentality, we got to do this work.
Yeah.
So let me read her bio and we'll jump right in because I know we have some good questions.
Yes, we do.
Okay, here we go. Julie Manano is a licensed marriage and family therapist specializing in emotionally focused therapy for couples. Julie's best-selling book, Secure Love, was published by Simon & Schuster in 2024. She also provides insight and advice for couples at The Secure Relationship on Instagram with over 1 million followers. She founded and runs the Bozeman Therapy and Counseling Clinic and the Secure Relationship Coaching. She lives in Bozeman, Montana, and with her husband and 6 children.
Ooh.
Woohoo. Welcome, Julie. We're so happy to have you here.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm really looking forward to this. I love your work.
Awesome.
Thank you.
You guys are doing great things in the world. So needed. So needed.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Well, you do a lot. I mean, a lot of your work and a lot of the stuff I see in your social account is around secure attachment and secure relationships, mm-hmm. which is very, very important.
Right.
So I feel like we should start by asking, tell us a little bit more about the work that you do, just so we have a little bit more of a context for our listeners, and then maybe we could even go from that into the different types of attachment styles in relationships.
Yes.
Give us
sure.
the 101.
So what I do is I use attachment theory, which I can kind of lay out in user-friendly terms here in a moment, but I use mm-hmm. attachment theory, which has been around since 1944 when a man named John Bowlby started discovering that these children, these kind of juvenile delinquents that he was working with, all had something in common, and it was mm-hmm. strained relationships with their caregivers. And it seems so obvious to us today, but at that time it wasn't obvious. The idea was that people are just sort of born with tendencies toward delinquency or depression or anxiety. And there might, you know, we can argue that there are genetic components to that. But what that did is it shifted the narrative from this is nature to really most of this is nurture. Mm. And so from there, attachment theory started becoming researched. Today, it's the most researched psychological modality out there, psychological theory out there. Mm-hmm. And it started, kind of jumped from the clinical world, those of us who are therapists, into the popular narrative, the laypeople narrative, maybe a decade ago, let's say. And it started to gain momentum because, in my opinion, and I think a lot of people, it's the closest science has come to describing in a really the most nuanced and understandable way how relationships actually work, what causes them to be successful and what causes them to fail. And that includes our relationship with ourselves, which is mm-hmm. tying into the work that you lovely ladies are doing. So I use all of this theory to help couples find secure attachment. And I don't just do that. I'm working in order to accomplish this goal. I can't just focus on bringing secure attachment into their relationship between each other. It's also a process of helping them become securely attached with their self, because mm-hmm. both have to be on board. So we're just kind of paralleling. I'm working with each partner on how are these behaviors in the relationship tied to your own insecure attachment? How are they getting in the way of the two of you having secure attachment together? And how is your insecure attachment together making you feel more insecure as a person? So that's what I do. I help couples become secure with each other and with themselves.
Wow. wow, what does that look like? Like, what does it look like to have like a secure on both sides?
What does a secure look like? It looks like I have access to my emotions. I can share my emotions. I can feel my emotions. I can self-regulate my emotions. I can kind of use my emotions as a way to inform me on how to approach a situation that's stressful. You know, my partner triggers me. My partner leaves the dish out once again. I've asked them 1,000 times. I can tap in and figure out, okay, what's going on with me? I'm feeling triggered. Like, I'm kind of getting a message here that maybe my needs don't matter to my partner. And what I want to do is kind of what I grew up having to do, which is just start protesting and telling them they don't care. But instead, I'm going to remember that I'm learning these new ways of being and approach this with emotional safety and communicate to my partner in a way that is more emotionally safe. And then so that's the second piece, right? Is not just having that emotional engagement and recognizing your feelings, but knowing how to regulate yourself. Right. So you're not just kind of spewing and, you know, everybody has these triggers, understandably. They all come from a really legitimate place, but I need to help people. So the avoidant partner in the relationship, my work with them is focused on helping them learn to emotionally engage. Okay. My work with the anxious partner is to help them learn to emotionally regulate. And when this happens, they both now start to have this secure attachment with themselves, their balance. They have a balance between heart and head. They're not just going into these defensive, protective, protesting places and getting stuck in these negative cycles. And with that, now they're able to show up with each other in a way that is called co-regulating, where instead of launching into protest with my partner, I'm going to show up and say, hey, listen, I know that the dishes aren't as important to you, right? I get it. Like, you have other things that are important to you that aren't as important to me. At the same time, it really does kind of help me out if I don't have to do, you know, all of it at once. Is there any way maybe we can come together on this? That communicates to your partner, hey, I care about your feelings. I care about your perspective. I get you. I care about that we're two different people in the world and we're not going to always see things the same way. And at the same time, I have this need for you from you. Can you help me out with that? And that partner is going to feel that emotional safety and they're more likely to self-reflect, to be collaborative. And it's not just that direction. I mean, it's that partner that is getting the emotional safety in this situation also needs to learn to show up in emotional safe ways.
So let's talk about, so we have the avoidant attachment style and the anxious attachment style. Are there any others, or those are the two primary attachment styles? And then you have the secure attachment style.
Yes, we have secure over here kind of in its own category. And then we have insecure. And insecure is an umbrella. And underneath this umbrella, we have avoidant. This person is going to manage their feelings by just stuffing them away. Don't rock the boat. Don't less likely to bring up concerns. If we start talking about the negative, we're going to feel disconnected or fight, or I'm going to be in an uncomfortable position to have to go into conflict that I don't want to be in. I don't know how to navigate conflict. And so what I'm going to do is just kind of stuff it all away. Now we can't, it's not possible to really fully do that. I mean, feelings are going to come out sideways or whatever. And then the anxious partner, they're over there just being, they're kind of opposite. Like, they're overwhelmed with their feelings. And it's really easy for them to make sense of these big feelings as, you're doing something to make me feel this way, which is true to some degree. Our partners absolutely can do things that are going to leave us feeling triggered, but it's kind of a narrow, myopic way to focus, and they're not really able to sort of recognize the differentiation between themselves and others. And they kind of get stuck in this idea that, you know, you're the problem because you're not showing up for me in the right way. You're the problem because you're not doing what I say. You're the problem because you're not wanting to go to relationship therapy. And it's really much more complicated than that. And so what happens is they're overwhelmed with their emotions, which are fear. When I see that bowl on the counter, my brain starts going, I've asked them 100,000 times. They must not care about my needs. Bowls make me anxious. It makes me feel like there's too much on my plate. I already am having a hard time keeping up with all the stuff in the house and taking care of the kids or whatever. So they must not care. And that narrative becomes their reality. And what are people going to do if they feel like their partner genuinely doesn't care about their pain and their needs? They're going to want to protest and say, hey, what's going on, buddy? Why are you doing this to me? Why are you hurting me? But they're missing a lot of the complexity of the whole situation.
And I'm assuming that this is probably like on a spectrum. Like you would, definitely. I'm assuming you might meet someone who has very anxious attachment style or characteristics of anxious. Can you ever find somebody who has like a mix of both, like avoidant and anxious? Or is it kind of like you tend to fit in one or the other?
I think my experience is that most people will really fit into one or the other. What I have actually a post on this on Instagram, because it's a little more complicated than that. I mean, you know, we can't have the attachment categories without them being there for a reason, right? So we need to have enough people fitting into the categories for them to make sense. So I think most people will, but if someone kind of resonates with both, that one possibility is they really do have both. They're just going to come out in different situations and, you know, people are complicated. They might have different parts of them come out in different relationships. And in that case, I'm getting all discombobulated here. There was something I wanted to say on that, but I can't remember. The other reason is that sometimes people really need a professional to help them figure it out because they're, you know, an avoidant partner can be big and loud and still really detached from their feelings. And an anxious partner can be really quiet and subtle, but still be really overwhelmed with their feelings, but protesting in more passive aggressive ways. And so sometimes we read these descriptions and we're like, wait a minute. But because there's a little more nuance to it, sometimes it takes a professional. The actual true attachment assessment needs to be, you know, we see all these quizzes online, right?
Which that's where I was going. Yeah. I've taken the quiz. I take all the quizzes.
I joke around because I always say sometimes these quizzes are like, which Harry Potter house do you belong to?
Basically.
It's like, but I'm a Gryffindor, but I'm also a Ravenclaw. The real attachment test is an inventory. It's an interview process. It's not multiple choice. It's given by a professional trained in attachment theory. And it's questions and answers. It's exploring someone's childhood, and it's read and interpreted by someone who has expertise in this area. So it's not always straightforward. My way of assessing attachment isn't to do quizzes. My way is to watch two people interact with each other for 5 minutes. And 90% of the time, I'm going to know the second someone walks into my office who's the anxious attachment, and here's how it's going to play out. They sit down and I say, hi, I'm Julie. I introduce myself. So what brings you here today? And the anxious partner looks at the avoidant and says, do you want to start?
Okay.
I get that. And then the avoidant will get a couple sentences out and then the anxious partner takes over. And what's happening here is that the anxious partner is turning to their avoidant partner and saying, do you want to be here? Are you invested? Are you going to show up? I don't want to be too much. So I'm going to give you the space to start talking. That's what's happening for them. And then the avoidant partner starts talking, and then the anxious partner starts going, wait a minute, none of this feels right. This feels threatening. And they get overwhelmed, and then they now just kind of take over because that's what they're used to doing.
I just have curiosity, too. Like, I don't want to make generalizations, but just I don't know how else to ask this question. Like, do you normally see the bulk of the people that you work with? Is it like usually speaking one's avoidant and one's anxious?
Yes.
Or, it's like we're drawn to each other.
That's interesting.
I mean, honestly, like, I think different clinicians can see different things. But in my experience, as dramatic as this sounds, it's, you know, 99% of the time, it's very, very clear cut. And there's a lot of background information that gets these two people to this place that they're sitting in my office being anxious and avoidant. But regardless of all of that, somehow in their distressed relationship, that's what it turned into. Because if you have one partner that's closing the distance, trying to get the problems resolved, bringing all this energy to the table, emotionally kind of big and protesty, what's right. the other partner going to do? The other partner's pull naturally back. Going to try to balance this out by mm-hmm. let's not talk about problems. It's going to turn into a big fight. And let's try to just keep things stable and try to keep things from getting worse. Now, that partner is emotionally disengaged. They don't know how to emotionally connect. They're afraid of conflict. They don't want to go there. And so now what are they doing? They're reinforcing the anxious partner's fears. We have a life to live together. We've got to work through problems together. I don't want to feel emotionally alone. And nobody's more or less at fault. They're really just playing off of each other. And the goal, the real balance that we need in that relationship is we need both partners taking responsibility for both of it. We need both mm-hmm, partners right. to have an invested interest in resolving problems and finding closeness and not getting into these big escalated fights and constantly talking about problems and never not, you know, if everything is, this is a problem, this is a problem. We need both partners taking responsibility for the balance. And that is because they are balanced individuals with secure attachment with self.
I have a question around that. So when you are seeking to like have secure attachments, for example, I don't know if you've ever had this clinically, but you have someone with more secure attachments and they're in relationship with someone who is insecure, whether it's mm-hmm. avoidant or what's the other
anxious
one? Anxious. Yeah. Mm-hmm. How, I guess, is there hope to shift the insecure attachment to a more secure attachment so that those two partners are able to remain in relationship? Or does there come a point, I know everybody can't be fixed or helped or sure. whatever, but does there come a point where it's like, you know, this person is going to want to relate in this way, this person is not shifting or maybe not even mm-hmm. aware of where they are. Do you get to a point with clients where it's like, okay, I can't help with this anymore, or I can't fix this, or what does that look like, yeah. I guess, in the clinical setting?
Well, you know, really, as I become a more skilled therapist, I mean, I've been doing this for, I don't know, over a decade, 12 years maybe now. Mm-hmm. I had that happen more often at the beginning. I am at a point now that I have so many skills and I'm so, you know, I've just become so seasoned and experienced at what I do that the vast majority of the people that I work with are going to both become invested. It's almost like we have a natural inclination to do this mm-hmm. work. Everybody does. I mean, there are definitely exceptions to that rule, but I think everybody has a natural inclination toward growth. One of my jobs is creating the emotional safety in that space so that I can get into that natural inclination. Mm-hmm. Now, it certainly doesn't stop there. I have to have other skills and help them communicate in healthy ways. But what I have found is that, you know, this work can be extremely successful, even when you kind of initially have one partner that's not sort of buying into it. And really what it boils down to is how able are you to be vulnerable? Because right. vulnerability requires not just the ability to talk about your feelings. For some people, talking about their feelings isn't vulnerable at all. For some mm-hmm. people, it's changing their behavior that's vulnerable. Mm. Because if yeah. I change my behavior and you don't follow suit, and I tell you something vulnerable and you don't respond in the way I like, I'm now going to have to sit with some yucky feelings, powerless, right. feeling rejected. And how willing are you to take that risk? So really, it's people who just can't do vulnerability for good reasons. We all have good reasons. You know, you grew up in a home where it was just too shaming. You cannot go into your shame. You don't feel safe. There have been super big wounds in the past in the relationship where you just kind of detached. The vast majority of the time, I absolutely see people who are willing to do this work and grow. But you have to understand something. I'm also the person that the people come to for help.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, I think I have, and I'd love your opinion on this because I'm starting to have this belief around therapy mm-hmm. That oftentimes when couples go to therapy, it sometimes feels like the success of the therapist is like inadvertently linked to the couple staying together.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I have a desire and a wish for that to maybe shift,
right? Mm-hmm. Because sometimes people don't need to be together, yeah. right? And so how do we, this is a bigger cultural issue, right?
Where, absolutely, yeah.
Especially for women,
right?
I'm sorry,
right.
but especially for women. I am so sorry, but I feel like if a man was like divorced like 3 times and a woman was divorced 3 times, like it would be mm-hmm. completely different perspective on that yeah. in terms yeah. of how people were perceiving them. And so my point with that is like, do you believe, I mean, I'm kind of getting to a point in my life where I'm like, oh, I wish this value would shift and that we could as a culture view people uncoupling as sort of a new mm-hmm. like a different way that we can just hold space for everybody's needs. Like
another way for mm-hmm. success.
Yeah. Too. Another way yeah. for success. Because you might have people who come in and work out their issues and mm-hmm. say, oh, I'm so happy that I've been able to, ultimately you're saying like, we're going to work out the issues in the, with the couple so that we can work out the secure stuff with ourselves. Mm-hmm. And we could still come to that conclusion and decide that we aren't a good match for each other, but at least we're making that decision, not from anxiety, not from being yeah. anxious or not from being avoidant, but right. from security. Absolutely. And so, I don't know, I just have been thinking about that yeah. a lot lately, about what it means in our culture to mm-hmm. to have this badge of honor to be with the same person your whole life. And I just have questions about that and curiosity about that.
Yeah, I'm really glad that you brought that up. And I appreciate you coming to those conclusions, because I 100% agree with that. And I do address this in the book that, mm-hmm. I mean, I had to let go a long time ago of the idea that I'm here to save a couple. I am not here yeah. to save a couple. I am right. here to create two people who are able to speak their truth. And yes. if they are able to speak their truth, you know, in a healthy way and reach each other, there is a chance that they will decide, hey, we aren't a good match. You know, mm-hmm. we do have different ways of being in the world that are so separate that we, you know, can't, we see things so differently. We want different futures. I mean, there's all sorts of good reasons that people don't want to go forward and live a life together. And like, as you know, to your point, if they can say that from a place of inner security, that's the healing. And what I have found is that when they get to that point, they want to be together anyway, but that's not yeah. the goal. And that's not yeah. true for everyone. I have had couples get to this place and they were able to really, you know, process and go through the idea that, hey, I want a family and you don't, and it's not, mm-hmm. you know, it's not workable for me. And then I just am there to help them, you know, communicate their feelings and really get through that grief process, that grief and loss. And I, you know, this is interesting because the subtitle of the book is Create a Relationship That Lasts a Lifetime. And that mm-hmm. was a point of contention between me and my publishing company, because I didn't want that subtitle. I wanted it. I don't feel that I'm creating relationships that last a lifetime. I feel that I'm creating healthy relationships, and a healthy relationship is more likely to last a lifetime if that's what you want. Gotcha. But they won. They didn't like my,
well, you know what? You have to
give in with publishing.
You're creating relationships with self that yeah. will last a lifetime, if nothing
exactly.
else.
So, that's interesting. Yeah. That's what someone said, because I put this once on an Instagram post, and someone said exactly that. You are creating yeah. yep, relationships that last a lifetime. So,
and let's move more into this secure relationship with self.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
because that's a lot of what we're trying to do here with the podcast, with WeShape. Sure. Is how do we move in the direction of creating that secure self? I mean, we're raised in a culture that is really not supporting that relationship to self. So what does that even, like, what does that even look like?
Yeah. It's pretty simple, yet pretty complicated at the same time. The simple answer is we know how to deal with our own feelings without doing things that harm us. Mm-hmm. So
I like that
might look like I look in the mirror. I don't like the way my body looks, because I have all these messages from society that are telling me I'm supposed to look a certain way. And that gives me a lot of anxiety, because mm-hmm. if society is telling me I need to look a certain way to be accepted, then now that's going to scare me. I'm going to feel like, what if I don't get accepted? What if I get rejected by society? What if I end up feeling alone, right? There's a lot of sadness in that. Mm-hmm. People who are afraid of feeling alone have felt alone in their life somewhere. They have felt a situation where they've had really deep, sad emotions come up and have been alone with them. And they're more vulnerable to wanting to please society, however that looks for them. So that inner work is not looking in the mirror and having these feelings come up and go, okay, I'm going to go run 5 miles and not eat today. The work is doing what I just did, which is diving in, feeling your fear, understanding what your fear is about, letting your body kind of process that, and then going, you know what? I'm not going to go hurt my body by not eating or running 5 miles, or which some people can run 5 miles. That's fine. It's coming from that like fear base. That's when it's a problem. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to nurture myself today. I'm going to have a good meal. I'm going to give my body the nutrition it needs. And I'm going to grieve the fact that this is really hard on me to not look like, in my mind, what society is telling me to look like. I'm going to, you know, just kind of let that pain be and still choose to take really good care of myself today.
I like that. I think the grieving part is so important. I think we miss out on that a lot. Like, absolutely. We are so inclined to like push through, like, okay, get through it, go through it, you know, get over it, wake up, like move on, be positive. And it's like,
absolutely.
If we don't stop and feel those feelings, like there's some repercussions down the line from that. So I'm so glad that you said like grieving and having those moments, and in the work that we do specifically, that is a real thing, grieving the bodies we used to have, grieving the bodies we thought we wanted to have, and then the flip side of that, still choosing to be kind. I think it boils down to respect. Respecting ourselves enough to say, you know what, I'm not madly in love with what I see in the mirror today, but I know that it's important and it deserves to be taken care of. So
I also grieve the years I lost in that world.
Right.
That's you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I'm like, wow, I wasted so much of my life obsessed with something that did nothing except harm me. You know, exactly. Accepting what is a life journey.
For sure. We'll be back in just a moment.
As a reminder, the Feeling Lighter podcast is a part of WeShape, a fitness app that is taking a very different approach. And I wanted to let everyone know about our upcoming Best Moves for You masterclass that WeShape is hosting that you can sign up for free. Take a look at weshape.com/class or click the link in the show notes.
And now back to the Feeling Lighter podcast.
What else do you have, Lisa? I know we're coming up a little bit on time, but we probably have time for another question.
Another one? I'll let you go. I think you had another one that was good.
Well, I have to ask because I'm like, tell me how you have 6 children, because I feel like I think that's incredible. And I'm like, how does this apply to my role as a parent?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I have 2 children, Lisa has 3, and it's, you know, we can all speak to like everyone has such different temperaments, such different attachment styles, such different. And so it's like sometimes, you know, I have this perpetual thing of like, I have all this, you know, I work on this growth in my life. And then I go, oh no, could we, like Lisa and I were talking about this morning, literally before this, we were like, wait a minute, we're supposed to break generational patterns and cycles and trauma and work on ourselves and then show up differently for our children. But like, could we pause the child raising so that we could this and then show up
back?
Because it's like, it is hard to learn and grow and then go, oh wait, pause. Can I go back 10 years? Because I just instilled that in my child. And like, I don't want them to have that part. And so if we're in the middle of our parenting journey, how does this work apply to that?
It absolutely applies. It's interesting because as a couples therapist, you would think that I apply this work more to my relationship with my husband, which I do, but this work has showed up more profoundly for me in my relationship with my children.
Wow.
And I think there was a real defining point for me. And the defining point was, it is not my job to, and it's interesting because each interaction with my child now is part of my self-growth. So they're not compartmentalized for me anymore like that, because every interaction with them, I have an opportunity to manage my own anxiety and show up in a new way. And that's where, for me, the parenting growth exists. So the defining moment for me, and I think it's different for, you know, different people, but the defining moment for me was making space for their feelings and not trying to move them away from them.
That's huge.
Because we constantly minimize children's feelings.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Especially because we find that what they get upset about is trivial.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But like, we don't put the lens on like, that's their world, that's really important to them.
Absolutely.
Right? Yeah. That's really, really valuable piece of advice for sure.
Thank you. That was it. I mean, that was the defining difference. And still today, I kind of get, you know, pulled into my own anxiety about my daughter calling me in tears because a teacher said something mean to her. And I just have to step back and remember, hey, my job is to just sit here with her and maybe call the teacher if this situation kind of calls for that. I don't mean like not protecting your kids when it's appropriate, but just to be like, honey, I'm so sorry. I'm just so sorry. I know that must have been so hard. Was that humiliating for you? Yeah, like I get that. And, and some parents might go, well, what did you do? What'd you do wrong? Or be at the school immediately or... You know, you need to look at it in a new way. The teachers are doing the best they can. And all of that stuff can be true and it can come later. But first, after we just need to make space.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great tip.
Yeah, I think that's what the heart. Yeah, I always have. It's like this is that perfectionism, right? It's like I don't want to see my children suffer at all. It's like that's like not really being a human.
Right.
And then to know that like how I've shown up as a parent is partially probably inflicting some of that suffering is like, it's just a tough pill to swallow, but I don't think we get out of causing, issues with her. I mean, I think that like we're doing the best that we can. And I appreciate your lens of like, I'm showing up in this relationship and I'm going to have stuff reflected back to me that will be growth for me. And growth doesn't mean that means I'm a good, perfect parent. Mm-hmm. Growth means that like I'm meeting them where they are and this is where I am and I'm going to make mistakes and that can be reflected and that's where my growth comes. But the mistake is still going to be there.
Yeah, it is.
And that's what's been the hardest part of my parenting journey, honestly, is just... I would say out of all the things I do in my life, and for many women, I think we can attest to this, but it's like the heartstrings that are pulled being a mother to children is like it debilitates me sometimes. Yeah. I'm like, oh my gosh, I cannot believe I am responsible. I place so much responsibility on the emotional outcome of this human being, and it's overwhelming, right? Yeah, so when it comes to the parenting stuff, like that is my biggest anxiety in life. And I'm sure I'm sure that's probably true for all mothers, but I can tell that it's like a lot fear-based, right? And
absolutely, yeah.
I'm like, I feel like I need to, like, that's why like I admire, I'm like, oh no, like if I had, like there is a part of me that definitely wanted to have more children, but my anxiety was like, absolutely not. Like you'll just crumble into a puddle on the floor because you haven't been able to like welcome, you know, imperfectionism and the fact that you are going to cause harm for them. Like there's just no way around that. And I just could not, I still have a really hard time just accepting that. Mm-hmm. And so I just admire your work and how this is impacting you as a mother. And so any advice you have for the mothers out there who just are often crushed with fear around how they are showing up for their children and breaking their own cycles. And I don't know, anything Absolutely. That a seasoned mother could share with us.
Yes, I'll tell you what, I totally relate to you. I had the same exact fears, the same exact feelings. It was absolutely brutal for me when my kids were young and my first two especially. And I mean, I was reading every parenting book out there to try to help myself help them. Mm-hmm. And my motivation for going back to grad school was because none of these books were really getting there and helping me. And I was like, I need to go figure all this out. I need to figure it out for myself because I cannot live with this intergenerational trauma and knowing that I was a piece of that. Okay. And, you know, once I discovered attachment theory, that's when everything started to click. And there was a real defining moment in my parenting journey where everything got better. And that was when I kind of figured out, okay, my job isn't to move them away from their pain. They're going to have pain. I'm going to cause them pain. Society is going to cause them pain. School is going to cause them pain. Stress is going to cause them pain. Body image is going to cause them pain. My number one job, yes, is to help and advise them. But more importantly, it's to create space for the pain. And there's one thing that's worse than suffering, and that's being alone with suffering. And as parents, we can't control all the suffering, but what we can do is we can help them not have to be alone, and we can hold their hand, and we can make space for the pain and not try to talk them out of it, not try to, you know, do all these things that we do based on our own fears and anxiety because we don't want our children to hurt. And instead, it sounds like, tell me about the hurt. Tell me how hard that is. That must be horrible. What was it like when I yelled at you in the car? I recognize that must have left you feeling really horrible and really small. And that was my own anxiety and I didn't handle it in the right way. And I'm super sorry for that. But at the same time, I just want to know how that impacted you. And that kind of conversation, just bam, it's good. They just need to know that you can hear and validate them. And they're absolutely, as parents, we need to be there as these guiding forces, these wiser, stronger others that can help them through life. But that can't come first. That has to come second. That has to come right. second to creating, allowing space for their emotions. And once that safety is there and they're more out of that red light part of their brain and into their green light, then we come in with, let's kind of maybe look at this. Let's problem solve it. Do you need my help? Sometimes they say, no, I'm good. I got it. You know, yeah. I really, really love it. It just ties in with everything I believe about parenting and everything that has truly helped me be the imperfect parent that I am, but very confident in my ability, is Gabor Mate's work on parenting.
Okay.
It's great.
Yeah. I've heard of his work. Yeah. I mean, we were talking this morning, like Lisa and I were in our 20s. You mm-hmm. were in your 20s too. When late 20s, when we had our children, I have mm-hmm. a dear friend of mine who's in her 40s having her children. And I'm like, oh, your children are so lucky mm-hmm. because they get this version of you. And I think, again, sitting with that grief and just acceptance, right? Because there are so many times where I wish, like my second child gets a better version of me.
Yeah. I know. It's so
and
true.
That's hard to accept, you know?
Yeah. You know, what's interesting though, is I always thought that too. I always thought, you know, my older two, I just was so strong. I was 25. I was struggling, mm-hmm. but I really wanted a family. But my older two got the worst of me, and my younger ones are getting the best of me. But then I see, because my youngest is 12, I'm like, they have just as many challenges. Just
as the older ones,
the best of me. Yeah. Like mm-hmm. there's just different challenges. So
yeah, it is. That's really good perspective. Yeah. I really appreciate that perspective for sure.
Yeah. Thank you.
Well, Julie, we loved having you on this episode. We got to talk about relationships and self parenting. Wow, it was like a full spectrum of life there.
So, we did the whole thing.
We did the whole thing. Before we let you go, though, we have to ask the big Feeling Lighter podcast question, which is, what is a belief that you once had that you no longer have, that you've shed, that has impacted your life in a big way?
You know, it kind of really ties into what I just said, which is creating emotional safety by holding people in their feelings. What I have found in my life that inspires change and inspires growth in others is meeting them where they are and just kind of allowing space and helping them make sense of why they think and feel the way they do. And just saying, hey, I get it. You have good reasons to be upset right now. And from there, we can motivate people to change. This works with my children. It works with myself. It works with my partner. It works with my clients, of course. And, you know, we do, change is important, right? Change is important for health. But in the past, my belief was the way that you inspire people to change, including yourself, is protesting, beating yourself up, you know, telling everybody what they're doing wrong, or just giving them all the information. And information outside of the context of emotional safety is as helpful as emotional safety without new information. So
that's powerful. Very powerful.
Yeah, that's
a good one. We haven't heard one like that before. That's a really good one.
I just thought of that, so I'll have to write it down.
Yeah, please, you should. Yes.
Can you tell people where to find you and connect with you?
Sure. Yeah. So my book, Secure Love, is out everywhere. Books are sold, bookstores, all the whole thing. And that really kind of is my journey from everything we're talking about, beginning to end. I start with attachment theory, and then I walk people through the process that I use in my work with couples to get to that place of healing. And then at The Secure Relationship is my Instagram, where I also have just tons and tons of information, same thing, on how to heal from all of this and how to kind of make sense of it. And I would say I try to really strike that balance between keeping it emotionally safe and presenting the information. Mm-hmm. You know, people need both. So the information is on Instagram. It's not, I can't always go into as much depth, and it's kind of more disjointed, the bit.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it kind of, you know, wherever you are in your journey, either or both can be helpful.
Well, we'll attach all those links for your Instagram and for your book in our show notes. Great. Thank you again for joining us, and really appreciate your time.
Okay. Well, you're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
See everyone next week.
Bye.
Thank you so much for listening, and we hope you enjoyed today's show. Now, before you go, it would mean a lot to us if you could take a moment right now to subscribe to the podcast and then leave us a review. This helps spread the word so more people can feel lighter by shedding one belief at a time. Also, we want to hear from you. So if this episode impacted you or you have any questions that you think would be great for us or any of our future guests, please feel free to email us at podcast@weshape.com. And finally, if you want to try WeShape's different approach to health and fitness, make sure you click the link in our podcast description or go to weshape.com/free, where you can build your first workout and activate your 2-week free trial. See you next week.